Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Stockyard Sessions podcast from Atlas Ag, the team behind Atlas Carbon and Meyer Grazing. My name is Matthew Peacock. This is episode 3, The Grazing Guru. And the grazing guru in question is Bart Davidson. Bart is Chief Grazing Officer for Atlas, and I've travelled to Baraba to meet Bart for this episode of the podcast. I'm going to go meet him for some breakfast now. We're going to have a conversation there, and then we're going to head off to a property about 30 minutes from here. Okay, breakfast finished, and we've got some coffee, so cheers to you, Bart, and cheers to coffee there. Two long blacks, look very good as well. And you can hear the coffee machine working away in the background. We're just sitting in the hotel by the main street through Baraba, so no doubt you'll hear some traffic noise in the background. And we're going to spend half an hour or so with Bart now, and then we're going to head off to a property nearby and have a look around. So again, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Time is all we've got, mate.
Perfect. Now, over dinner last night, you were telling me around about where we are, and we're in the centre of some pretty impressive grazing country here. Can you just expand on that a bit?
In a simple sense, cropping has always taken front and stage of the better soils globally for obvious reasons. And, you know, I spend so much of my time in grazing, and grazing tends to be the poor cousin. The soils tend to be poorer, the landscapes tend to be more weathered and the less fertile and beautiful. And what I love about Baraba, where we are now, we're on the edge of the Peel Fault, which is a pretty well-known geological event that's created this massive fault line, and either side of it we have these basically, you know, volcanic activity, beautiful basalt soils that are just deep, rolling, fertile. But we're up off the floodplain, we're up off the flats, so we're not in such well-known cropping country, but we're in some beautiful, beautiful soils that just produce big, strong animals because there's loads of minerals, and it's not common in Australia to see that.
Thank you for hosting me here today. Feel very privileged to be here. Tell me a bit about your role to start with as Chief Grazing Officer. What does that look like day in, day out, and what do you enjoy about the role?
Not nearly enough grazing, Matt, a lot of the time. Really, it's soils that intersection of soils, carbon and livestock, and then that inevitably means people, right? None of that happens without people making decisions, good management, poor management, everything in between. So I guess if I step back, fundamentally my role is trying to make sense of numbers, trying to see the cycles, see the patterns, work out what good looks like. You know, what is this set of numbers actually telling us? Are we talking about a day, a week, a graze, a paddock, a farm, a landscape? A change, a step ahead, a step backwards. What does it actually mean? What are the numbers telling us? Really pretty fortunate. It's a pretty open-ended role.
Have you solved the conundrum yet?
Well, there's no one conundrum. There's plenty, Matt. There's quite a few that we can work into. There are riddles all the way through the landscape, and certainly when you mix that up with people and livestock, there's more and more.
Brilliant. We've got a lot of ground to cover. I want to talk more about you, the man, and your role and your career in agriculture. But importantly, I want to talk about soil carbon projects and the potential of soil carbon projects for producers to increase productivity and how they can go about doing that. So lots of ground to cover. First things first, obviously I've been stalking you as part of my prep for this. And your definition of agriculture on your LinkedIn profile, Mr. Davidson, is if you eat, you're involved. Tell me a bit more about that.
I need to log in more often, Matt. I'd forgotten about that. I think that's a pretty simple, for me, that's a super simple. I'm really glad that you found that, to be honest. I wasn't sure what would be there. I had a pretty formative mentor at uni, actually. He was a farmer that became an ecologist, that became an academic. His name was David Dumerick, and I remember where I was when he said, if you eat, you're involved. Mm. And it really just punched me in the face. So that's why I'm in agriculture.
Yeah.
Fundamentally. And it just really speaks to the heart of the whole thing. People get distracted by all the moving parts. There are a lot of moving parts in agriculture, but fundamentally, if you eat, you're involved, and there's no politics, there's no right or wrong. It's just about something that binds us all together.
You described ecology as love at first sight. I think through interviews I've heard you do previously, you feel a connection with nature that perhaps other people don't. Where does that come from, and how does that manifest itself day in, day out?
I can't pretend to have a different connection to other people. I think for me personally, it is really simple. Everything's full. Nature, ecology is really the arbiter. So ecology takes over. Ecology always wins, whether it's the kitchen being a mess, mold, fungi, the backyard, the kitchen, the garden getting out of control, the spiders, the earthworms, the compost. Then you go out into the broader landscape, and then you get out into the paddock, then you get out into the entire valley. Ecology wins, and for me, it's best when it's brutal. I find that the only way to actually step back and see things for what they are is to, it's nature. Let's call it nature, but it's ultimately just removing everything else, and there we are, faced with ourselves as humans in this timeless landscape. That's what gets me.
A phrase I've heard you use previously is helping the landscape find its balance, and that resonated with me. Can you explain that in a bit more detail and how you go about trying to achieve that?
I actually don't recall saying that, Matt. I think maybe what I was getting at there is, when I see a farm, when I'm working with a farm, again, a farm is always a landscape. A paddock is part of the farm. The farm is part of the landscape. The farm might be the landscape. There are all these forces at play. It's gravity. It's weathering. It's erosion, it's building, it's cycling, it's intersections of energy, man-made and otherwise. And one of the most fundamentally beautiful things to see is those forces of ecology, nature, gravity, movement, animal, intersecting with good decisions, sometimes poor, actually changing stuff. It just fundamentally changes. And then, whether it's a month, a year, a decade, it's a fundamentally different set of moving parts that then affects other things, water flow, water quality, species that weren't there before, platypus popping up that weren't there, insects that are filling horizons, that fish are eating that weren't there before, all because we changed the way that we graze the grass.
Yeah.
That gets me.
Yeah. So have we been doing it wrong for many years, and are we starting to right those wrongs, or is that just too much of a generalization?
Yeah, I honestly don't think in right or wrong. Personally, there are too many examples of people and systems trying to be binary about it. It being this way or that way, good, bad or ugly. Honestly, I think it's about incremental shift. It's about incremental feedback loops. And feedback loops is a good place to start this, right? One of the reasons that people say it's good or it's bad is the absence of a feedback loop that gives some sensitivity to the deal. Maybe it's bad, but maybe it's actually a really important step towards recalibrating and rebalancing. And grazing-wise, I think there's no doubt an appreciable shift in what has become normal. It used to be either set stocked or crazy rotation. Right. Now there's a much broader set of examples in between where people are still working it out. And there are examples of absolutely fantastic and there are examples of absolutely terrible, but I think there's a whole lot more in the middle now. It's really not unusual for grazing to be in the middle, and we're not seeing the screaming, terrible examples of bare ground, dust storms, animals dying. I think we've moved on from the 70s and the 80s, the drought, the victim of the drought mentality. That's really shifted. I think the bottom has come up in terms of its regard for how it manages land. And the top, those people that are at the best of it, it's just built in.
Yeah. And the focus all the time is on productivity, right? We're going to go look at a soil carbon project later, but I know that's the sort of lead for you. It's build your productivity first, and then there are other benefits that come from doing that.
Yeah, it's always struck me as intriguing that we now talk in terms of carbon projects and natural capital and so on. When I go back to people that mentored me in soils and soil chemistry and grass production and grazing and cropping for that matter, and you boil it all down to the simple stuff, the mineral composition and soil health, back at a time before it was being measured for accreditation or otherwise, carbon was the best proxy we had for whether we were doing the right thing. Was carbon going up? Was carbon going down? There's all these other numbers too. And obviously production, the unit of production per hectare of whatever. But if carbon was going up whilst we were doing that, whatever it was working. Mm. And if it was going down, whatever it wasn't working. And I don't mean on Monday to Tuesday, I mean over many years. So I think that's a simplistic way of looking at it, but you don't begin with carbon. It's the outcome. It's for better or worse, it's the lagging indicator of how we've been going.
Yeah.
It's really hard to rig it. You know, it's a slow moving actual substance. You know, it's carbon. It's not a nutrient for growing grass, or it's part of so many equations, but it's just so fundamental. So production first, because that's how we get paid. Yes, we can expand on that. It's just so fundamental to me that it's not separate.
Obviously, there are some naysayers around the potential of soil carbon sequestration. There's question marks around permanence. Data is all important to try and, you know, overcome those hurdles. Where do you sit in the debate and the argument, and what's your view?
Time is a big element in this. Despite everything I said, we're still in a young industry.
Yep.
We're still in a market that is, well, we're in a market that is dealing with an economy that is working out how to decarbonise, some more quickly than others. So within that, time is not our friend right now, because there aren't enough years of some well-established mature markets dealing with carbon, for example, let alone natural capital and biodiversity and the rest of it. That all evolves over time. I think it's happening quite quickly. I think it's happening quite sensibly. I think there are some really strong frameworks. Well, we happen to be one of the strongest in Australia, because time was put into the maths of ultimately confidence in the outcome. If you think about, I don't want to name names, you think about a Rio or a BHP or an Exxon or a big oil company, if they're going to pay for a credit, they want to have confidence. Mm. And one of the fundamentals that, again, is leading bloody obvious, but people tend to forget, carbon, you can't see it. Mm. You trade a ton of wheat, okay, there's a ton of wheat. You trade a 500 kilo cow, okay, there's a 500 kilo cow, give or take the margin. Here's a ton of carbon. Where is it? I can't see it. Mm. Okay, so therefore, is it a leap of faith? Well, yes, but no. Why no? Well, let's measure it. And then how do we measure it? And what are the refinements of that measurement process? What are the costs of that measurement process? What are the timelines on that measurement process? What are the sensitivities to that measurement process? Those are the things we're working through here. And so there's all of that, and there's a lot there. And we're very fortunate, as I say, in Australia to have a regulatory framework that is, diligence first, market second. Little old blokes like me that have been walking around paddocks for quite a while, and I look at data that pre-existed carbon projects from an agronomic point of view, a production point of view, and yes, a soil health point of view, I'm pretty comfortable with what we're doing, because over the decades, that's where these things really matter. It's not a month-to-month deal. It's about changing a landscape over years. So we just get it right.
What does the future of measurement on farm look like from your perspective? What are we driving towards in 3, 5, 10 years' time in terms of the data that we need to gather and how we need to be measuring more effectively?
Yeah, and I've got to remember, I'm an old guy, right? I somehow became old, and
he's not old, by the way.
I say that in jest, right, because I'm a grandfather too, don't forget. So I actually am a bit old. I have been pulling soil plugs for quite a while. You know, it's 30-something years, and I think, wow, that's a hell of a long time. What has changed through that period of time? What are we doing when we actually soil test? Well, we're ground truthing. We have a set of assumptions. There might be a theory around what this thing looks like, and we're going to go and make a set of decisions around what we might do on this thing because of this thing, you know, whether that's inputs, outputs, species change, interventions around pasture or cropping or otherwise. What the soil testing does is give us some feedback loop. It gives us some numbers. Even the numbers can be messy. That's all very analog. That's all very beta, still VHS. Mm. But you know what? It works. It works to the extent that there's sensitivity to the area that it represents. You know, you can't take one soil sample for a farm and pretend that that's the farm. You've got to have representation of all the different parts of the farm. And then, therefore, you've got all the cost, all the time, all the stuff that people basically generally fall down on. And the future, I think, I can't imagine a world. I mean, if we can do Starlink and we can put people in the space, I can't imagine what's stopping us from having smarts that actually have, at some point we get a real-time carbon on the balance sheet. I don't know how many years off that is, but we get to the point where there's enough data points, there's enough flux, there's enough transfer of ins and outs. Ultimately, we're talking about modelling, interpolation of actual ground truthing back to output. But I think it just becomes, it's like the weather. I think we become, you know, we've come a long way in understanding the weather patterns, weather modelling. Yes, you can argue that it can still be terrible. Same as finance. You've got to follow the money. It needs more money to get to the point where It's live, it's real, it's trustworthy, it's high confidence, it's there. And it's doing well over here, it's doing poorly over there, it's doing exceptionally over here, it's got strong pattern, lock it in. And the challenge is to get from here to there.
Yeah. We're going to talk more when we get to the farm shortly around basic fundamentals of good grazing management and what it means to focus on performance. So anyone listening hoping to get some advice from Bart, that will come shortly. We talked about the future a minute ago. I'd just like to reflect on the past. And again, hearing you in other interviews, it sort of seems to me that the phrase sustainability and what it means to incorporate sustainable agricultural practices is something that you've been aware of for a very long time and maybe ahead of the curve of others. I'm not sure about that. But did you see where we currently are now in agriculture coming 10, 20 years ago? And has it sort of played out like you thought it might in terms of the need to demonstrate sustainable practices?
Yeah, good question. I'm certainly not a prescient seer of the future. I'm like everybody else, running to catch up to the world as it is now. If I do step back, I guess I had a relatively unique beginning in agriculture. I'm not from a farm. I'm not from farming. When I went to uni, I went to aeronautical engineering. I actually wanted to be a pilot.
Nice. And I can see that.
That didn't work out so well. So failing that, I thought, let's apply the math that I seem to love and get into aeronautical, because then I can at least have an impact on the speed and the agility of these bombers that we want to be talking about. And best thing in the world is it just didn't float my boat. So after a couple of years, I went bush, stayed in the bush. And so if thinking about the sustainability thing, I went bush, did what so many country kids in Australia do, spend time on farms, wandering around for a few years. And I had no right to understand anything to do with farming. All I did was watch. All I did was be the lackey. I worked on a bunch of farms and I just couldn't really understand them. And I happened to work in some farms that were high intensity vegetable farms, fruit and veg. Not so much the extensive grazing, though I saw that too. And I really couldn't understand how it worked because it was pretty much rip and tear. It was pretty brutal. We're talking back in the 90s. And it motivated me to look around, and I found my way into science degree, looking at soil chemistry. Certainly went pretty hard studying ecology, the intersection of that with people and soils, all the usual stuff, chemistry. But it just didn't make sense to me from a mathematical point of view, the amount of energy it took to produce parcels of food. It just didn't make sense. Mm. And so that was the beginning of looking at stuff. Happenstance again, but I happened to run into, I'd never heard of organic farming. I'd never heard of biodynamic farming. I read Steiner's work. That really intrigued me, biodynamics. Couldn't quite get my head around the esoteric elements of that. But then I looked at the maths of that and I go, wow, we're actually talking about the angle of attack between the oxygen molecules in the H2O and its impact on how minerals are absorbed into another organism. I think there's something going on there.
Yeah.
So let's have a look at that. And one way or another, I ended up being fortunate enough to spend the first few years of my career wandering around organic farms in every state of Australia, funnily enough, and a lot of different landscapes. And I had no right to have that much exposure to so many different types of farming so early in my career. But I saw the best, the worst, and everything in between. And again, it just struck me that it wasn't about a label, it wasn't about a brand, it wasn't about an ethos, because there were some fantastic farms and there were some terrible farms. And then to your point about the sustainability thing, there are just so many examples of it not quite working. And again, I'll go back to raw, hard study. There aren't that many examples of agriculture that have been around for a very long time.
Mm.
They just aren't.
Mm.
And I mean millennia. But there aren't. So we're not on a given here that we actually survive the next 2 million years because we're doing what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So I've always just said, okay, let's step back, find out what works. And that's how I got going. What's working really? What does good look like? I want to learn that. I want to study that. I want to be the best at that. And then if that works, let's see where that takes us.
Fantastic. You're listening to the Stockyard Sessions podcast. My guest is Bart Davidson. We're recorded. The bells are ringing in Baraba. So, the clock tower that we can see just through the window behind us. I'm going to jump in my highly underperforming hire car. You're going to jump on your motorbike and, we're going to head off to a property in a minute. Don't go too fast. Remember, I'm going to be following you to the farm. So don't leave me for dead, will you?
We'll be good.
Thank you. Before we leave, and the coffee's almost finished, is it then the marriage of mathematics and farming for you? And how do those two come together from someone that is terrible at maths and it's not my thing?
The maths of farming, it doesn't get talked about. First off, fascinating that it doesn't get talked about. But as an entity, as a thing, farming, agriculture, is data rich. It's absolutely data rich. You know, you compare it to aviation, you compare it to finance, you compare it to banking, compare it to telecoms. It's data rich. It's awesome. You know, there are so many different intersecting pieces of data on a daily, you know, minute to minute, day to day, week to week, month to month. But you know what? It's all beta. It's all VHS. Has been. It's getting better, but it has been. And back to an earlier comment you made about time, I recall being heavily immersed in cropping, irrigated cropping. I spent a lot of time irrigated cotton or irrigated wheat, irrigated intensive horticulture. And I spent time with a guy, David Turner, was a fantastic farmer. David and Betsy Turner really were mentors of mine. And David said to me when I was in my 20s, he had seen massive change go through the cotton industry. Enormous shift quickly. And as an example of change in agriculture, that was a really stark one of, some bad press to some awesome press. And we started looking at grazing, started looking at simpler systems. And he said to me that it will take 50 years for the change that you're thinking of here, and back to your sustainability point.
Yeah.
And I said, no, that's rubbish. Can't be. Look at the change that's going on. This is going to happen. We're at the front end of a major change going on here. Mm. He said, yeah, sure. And he'd been doing it, right? He was a guy that was doing it, not talking about it. And it's now 25 years later. And sure, greater awareness. There's a whole bunch of improvement in the way that data is generated, the way that data is amalgamated and formed up into decision-making and feedback loops. It's streets ahead of where it was. But it's still way off where it needs to be. And so the maths of farming, it's got enormous scope. And if you wanted to boil it down to what that means, for me, it's being really comfortable and confident with what great looks like. And then what does poor look like? Mm. And that might be in a paddock. It might be in a comparison of a group of paddocks. It might be in a CEA of a carbon project. It might be in a part of the valley, part of the farm, or the whole landscape. And what's generally missing is that sense of context. Most people a farm is generally, it's highly uncommon for a farm not to have more variation within it than the variation with the farm next door.
Sure.
Right, that's crazy. Mm. And what will typically happen is that, you know, the family that owns the farm understands the variation on their farm. They're very familiar with the good. They tend to forget the poor. They work with the bits in between, whatever that might look like, whatever area that is. But then they've got no context of how that relates to the other 99.9% of the farms that are similar to them for rainfall, temperature, soil type, whatever. And so that whole context is missing. So for me, the maths of farming is really simple. You just break that down.
Yeah.
Right? Why wait two or three generations to understand why this part of the farm does really well and that part of the farm does really poorly? Let's build some metrics around it. And those metrics are there. They're not difficult to roll out. And so that's what the maths of farming means to me. Context so that I have confidence to make decisions, and I being the people that are doing this stuff, not the royal we, though I do love making decisions, to do it with confidence and then have a feedback loop that says, you know what, you nailed it. Mm. Or you know what, you're 10% off. Mm. That's cool. You know what, that was a big fail. But let's fail fast if we're going to fail. Let's find out fast. Reset, course correct, boom, baby. And that to me is the maths of farming. And people have always kind of felt that it's devoid of numbers, but they're everywhere.
Mm. Yeah. How interesting. Look, finally, before we do head off, I just want to talk about the relationship that you build with producers. obviously there needs to be a level of trust there. You're a consultant, you're advising them, you're giving them information, you're sharing knowledge. Is that a really important part of your job as well, building those relationships with farmers and having those trusted and open conversations about where things are going right, where things are going wrong, how you can improve in the future? You know, that's not an easy thing to do. And I think you're either a sort of natural relationship builder with people or you're not. Mm. So where do you see yourself in that area?
Good question. You know, a lot of people will tell you that I'm someone that loves not to be around people. I'd much rather be in a cave somewhere thinking about numbers, which is true too, or hiking a river or climbing a mountain.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, another saying I have that I've always gone back to, people are people through people. And whilst I talk about numbers and maths and landscapes and all the rest of it, our landscape is the outcome of people. It's the outcome of decisions and management.
Yep.
You know, a paddock is the result of 1,000 stories that have happened through time. So I need to work with people, and I actually do enjoy that. And typically the reason for that is that people care, right? It's not happenstance. It's not, I'm going to buy a red car versus a blue car, and that's the kind of car I like. We're talking about people that have an intrinsic, deep love and understanding to different levels of the country that they manage.
Mm.
Whether they own it, whether they lease it, whether they inherited it, whether they bought it, it's a pretty deep connection. And it's one of the unique elements of agriculture versus all those other industries. And so for me, I don't see myself as a chemist disposal or a GP. You know, I think there's all sorts of that kind of stuff in farming which is necessary. You know, I have a problem, what's the answer? I have a problem, what's the answer? I have a problem, what's the answer? And then they get the dispensary and the script says, put on 10 units of that. Put on, do XYZ over there.
Yeah.
Do XYZ over there. Keep going. And I've never been comfortable with that, although I've done plenty of that because that was part of the role for many years as well, and a good learning exercise as well. That doesn't solve problems. It's really just propagating forward whatever we're doing right now, but with a different colour or a different texture. And for me, the people thing, it's about finding the envelope. People generally know what they need to do. People generally have a good sense of what the deal is because it's just so important not to get it wrong. What they're looking for then is the envelope. Where's the sensitivity? Where's the point at which if I go past that, I actually achieve a meaningful change? Mm. Or if I'm underneath that, I'm just poking along and I'm going to be here for another 10 years with no change. And so my role is to help point that out. It has to be principle-based, has to have a framework for me to understand it, for me to work with it. Otherwise, you're shooting from the hip and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So build the framework, and then people can relate to a framework because they can remember what the rules of that framework are or the thinking within that is. What's the logic of that to then have confidence and familiarity themselves with their own processes? And that's one of the most rewarding, fulfilling elements of anything that we can do is to see people take ownership over decision making that drives the farm that is their life, that is their business, because they've got stronger systems, and you help contribute to that because they've got all. And there's no end of them. We might pretend, but we're actually just contributing to elements of that.
Sure.
in the greater scheme of a farm.
Yeah,
and so I think it's incumbent on anyone that's working with a farm to have that approach. But you can't come into that empty. You can't come into that asking and needing. You've got to be able to give. You've got to be able to find a balance that that prompts and triggers and challenges and instigates something that they can grab onto and I wouldn't say die in a trench for, but actually fight for.
Yeah, to deliver meaningful change over time. That's really interesting. Really interesting. Now, where are we headed off to? Where are you taking me?
Well, we've just had a couple of days at a beautiful set of farms, Yarrandabby, around halfway between Bingara and Baraba, and seen heaps of that. There's a recent baseline at Castletop with Scotty Michelle that is to our northwest that I haven't seen for a while, and I'm stinging to see it actually. Post baseline is one of my favourite junctures to go and visit a farm and see where we're at, how's it going, what's happening, what's not happening, why, what's it look like.
Great. I'll look forward to getting your views on all that when we arrive. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Matt.
So about an hour's drive later, and a beautiful drive it was, we've arrived at Castle Tots. There's a bit of breeze going from the right to the left, which you might be able to hear on the microphone. I'm sure you can hear cattle being very vocal in the background. And this is a stunning spot. We're surrounded by mountains, hills, trees, lots of wildlife, lots of bird life. And I'm back with Bart Davidson. Tell me about where we are, Bart. Give me a quick overview.
Well, we're on the eastern side of the Nandi War Ranges. We're on a north-south slither of pretty strong clay soils that have their ups and downs. There's strong stuff, weak stuff. We've got a farm that's been in the same family for quite a few generations, as happens so often. We've got a bloke that runs that, owns that with his family, who feels, a debt to the past and the future is the way I think of that. And he's loving it. He's showing us his farm. We've been here before. We're coming back over it to see how things are looking. Where's the envelope? Where are we? It's the context. Where are we? And where are we right now? Well, yeah, we're on some country northwest of Baraba, east of the ranges. Lovely spot.
It is beautiful. What do you see when you look out across this paddock? Is it sort of matrix and beautiful mind and numbers and code coming at you? Or, you know, what do you see that other people might not see when you're standing here?
I'm nothing special. I think it's really just, well, my first thought is, what did it look like last time I saw it?
Yeah.
What did it look like last time Scott saw it? What does it look like the last time these cattle saw it? Context, what's the comparison? Where are we? Where were we? And for me, right now, this looks pretty good. This looks pretty sweet. We've got a bunch of feed, and, well, we're at the right time of year for a bunch of feed. It's just warmed up. We've just hit go. Soil temperatures have come up. Today, woke up 17 degrees. Insects in the air.
Yep.
Last week it was 8s and 7s, and not that long ago it would have been a frost. So we're at the front end of the growing season where this is it, right? This is when everyone's excited. We've got calves on the ground. We've got trees blossoming here. We've got bees out there. If it doesn't look good now, well, probably never will. So
If you want to hear from Scott from Castle Tots, where we are now, then we interviewed Scott for episode 2 of the Stockyard Sessions, along with his daughter, Macy. So if you haven't heard episode 2 yet and you want to hear from Scott, who runs this property, Castle Tots, then please go ahead and do that. So we'll broaden it out away from this specific property in a second, but in terms of the soil carbon journey for Scott, where is he up to and what happens next? Do you have to measure some more to track progress? What's sort of on your mind of what you need to do here over the next 12 months?
Yeah, really, that's a good question. So I forget the months, so I wouldn't even tell you what day it is today. I know that not long ago this place was baselined. It must be circa somewhere between 6 and 12 months ago. I was last here. Our crew came through. We did the prelim sampling,
yep,
soil testing, essentially working out where we are, whether to go ahead or not. And since then, Scott's baseline, which is a big deal, get the baseline done, get it all squared away, tick that box, get registration sorted, have all the numbers right, and then get stuck in. And Scott was always one of those guys, his archetype is, eager beaver. I want to get going. I want to do this. I want to get going. I know what I want to do. Let's do it. What does it look like? Well, we were just talking with him then about rolling out some infrastructure, and it can certainly differ from farm to farm and different parts of different farm to different farm. But for Scott, it was really simple, right? Let's get some waters in. Let's get some fences in, water and wire, and then get stuck into the grazing, because he recognised that he didn't quite have that where he wanted it to be. Unfortunately, that became the eligible activity.
Mm.
So that's pretty cool. But in terms of numbers, baseline would have been the last big one. And in terms of what I want to see, personally, it's not about right or wrong. It's actually just a chance to check in on the momentum. Is there some? What's the trajectory? Have we got something that's looking like moving the needle? What does moving the needle look like? Are we talking 5%? Are we talking 50%? What's the envelope that we're working in here? And season has a big influence on that, and here we are, it's a cracking time of the year. Things look pretty good. We've got a lot of grass. Got to be pretty conscious of that. So it's not about whether the grass looks good or whether country's in good state. It's more about what are the decisions that are being made. I'm listening to Scott. How does he describe stuff? What language does he use to think about what he's doing?
Yeah.
Has that changed since we first started talking to Scott, because that's a pretty key element of all of this, you know, how you communicate, how you think about you being him. How does he think about the exercise of going from A to B to C to D through the farm to harvest this spring feed?
Yeah.
I'm after some essence of what that sounds like and what that looks like and what does that come through in numbers. Is it too early? Probably is for a few numbers. But there are some tells along the way. And the best ones are in the grass. The animals, a bit of a signal too, but definitely grass, recovery periods, all the stuff we can chat about.
Fantastic. When you drive around so many different properties as you do and visit different properties, are there sort of trends that you see around grazing management that perhaps need to change or be altered? You know, what common trends do you see?
Yeah, good question. I guess we all become normalised. Right? Normal for me is normal, is not normal for a lot of other folks.
Yeah.
If I was to categorise, and I don't want to be too generalistic, too general here, but I guess if I was to stop and explain this to someone at the pub who'd never really thought about it, what I would tend to see is pure, simple, set stocked, set and forget. Right? It's a pretty simple model. You get get a certain number of animals in a certain paddock for as long as you like. And then you come back and check them every now and then. That's pretty simple. It's set stocking. And there's variations of that too, and it's never quite that simple, but there's that. And then you've got that doesn't quite work for me at this stage of the game, so I'm going to start moving them around. I've got bulls, I've got heifers, I've got cows, I've got to do this, I've got to split the sheep off, I've got to do whatever. And then next thing you know, you actually are rotating. Not that you're talking about it being rotation and you haven't done any training and it's not about rotational grazing, but it just is the case that you're moving this group of animals through this part of the farm at this time of year because that's the story of this farm. That's what we do.
Mm.
And then you've got the next level, which is the folks that have had a bit of a crack at some training, insights, learning, experimenting, looking at what things like rotational grazing or adaptive grazing or holistic management or what have you might look like, and they start rotating. And they don't quite finish the book. They say, oh, this is pretty cool. Okay, let's do this thing where this thing becomes moving animals around, but it's incomplete. And so they end up, and I'm just generalizing badly here, but they end up rotating out of grass.
Mm.
It's a common movie I see, right? So I'm working out, are we in that movie where it's all pretty cool for a little while, but then the structure's not right. The infrastructure's not there. The pattern's not there. The intent in terms of the planning, there isn't any. It's really just rotating.
Yep.
And it's just a bit dizzy and it's a bit ad hoc and it's a bit whatever. And people get excited about it for a while and it tends to work for a little while too, but ultimately whether it's 3 months, 3 years, they rotate out of grass.
Mm.
And that's, I mean, why is that? Well, it's probably the maths of stocking rate. The rotation aspect's right, but the buffering of stocking rate to the feed in front of them, the feed that's on the farm, and ultimately the carrying capacity isn't quite right. The feedback loop isn't there for them to alter that as they need to, whether that's 3 months or quarters or seasons. And it doesn't quite work, and then they get a bit jaded and they end up going back to where they were. And then the other end of that spectrum, if there is one, is Johnny Cash. He's just rocking. Right? Mm-hmm. We've got it. We haven't just got the principle or the concept of moving animals around to get animal impact, put them on fresh feed, all that simple stuff. They've actually got a structure to how they think about it. They've got a language to how they compare the past with the present, with the future, in terms of feed that they've got, how they're going to feed it, who's going to eat it, how long it will take them to get through that part of the farm, when they'll be back.
In terms of soil carbon projects, do you feel in the minds of producers there are still barriers to participate? And whether that's the ongoing in offsetting debate, what would you say to producers who want to start a similar journey to what Scott has got here? And I'm sure you come across producers all the time that ask you that question, what's the first step that I should make? What do you feel needs to happen to get more producers involved in soil carbon projects?
There's two elements to that. The latter part was the bit that I really got was how to prioritise, where do I start, what do I do?
Right? Yep.
That bit's easy. We can talk about that. The bit before that with the whole natural capital carbon project, something outside of what I know as a farmer, something outside of what I do week to week, month to month.
Yeah,
that's a whole other equation, and I think that's a tougher one because there's a lot of mixed messaging. There's a lot of gaps in how the farm works. You go to the accountant, it's all pretty straightforward. We've got the balance sheet, we've got the P&L, we sold stuff, we bought stuff. Okay, that's the result. And now people are talking about biodiversity and they're talking about carbon. That's all a bit less tangible. Where is it on the accountant's sheet? A carbon project, I guess, does actually start to formalise that, because you actually do have this structured process where you do take a baseline, you do then say, I'm going to take on an eligible activity, I'm going to do something to move the needle and change the carbon numbers in my soil. Okay, great. Before that, I think that's a bit abstract. It's really a focus on, and always is, a focus on, for this farm, how do we grow more grass? How do we intersect more of that grass with the soil, grow deeper perennial root systems that pull in moisture, improve and embellish, if you like, the mineral cycle, the carbon cycle, the water cycle? Then you start talking about the rest of it. Because if you don't, I just feel like we're having the wrong conversation. We're trying to materialise and monetise and articulate something that is a bit intangible. It has to be, on this farm, how can we do a better job of whatever it is that we are converting into a product that someone wants to buy, that improves, increases, embellishes the water, mineral, carbon, mineral cycle. And then we're on the right track. Otherwise, it just gets confusing.
Yep.
Well, the process that tends to come out of the carbon prelim, you know, we call it the prelim viability assessment. We come in agnostic. We take a bunch of soil sites. We take a bunch of cores. We look at the topsoil. We look at the subsoil. We look at the carbon. We look at the bulk density. We look at the mineral levels. We look at how it all hangs together with conductivity, trace elements. We coalesce. We find the patterns. We basically group it up. We do some modelling. And then we come back and, you know, agnostic, we then come back to the guy, the lady, the family, and say, this is what we think. This is how it looks.
Yep.
How does that look to you? And they go, that bit's wrong, but this is right. This is how it's formed. This is how grass moves on this farm. It's like that. Yes, that's exactly right. But this bit just needs to tighten up a bit over here.
Mm-hmm.
And we've given them numbers and words and structure for what they intrinsically, instinctively understand as the farm, but have never had a tapestry for. They've never had an easel, if you like, to say,
yep,
this is how we run the farm.
Yep.
Look, we need to round up, and I just want to think about the future for you and for the farmers that you work with through Atlas. What do you see for your career over the next 3 to 5 years? What would you like to happen? Obviously, you're happiest when you're on your bike up the farm drive. I saw that in action today, and obviously you're very relaxed out here talking to producers. This is sort of, I think, where you're most comfortable. So farm consulting is in the future for you, not a lot to change. You want to keep pushing, doing what you're doing? Or?
No, I don't really see farm consulting into the future. My long-term goal was always to go and get 4,000 cows and have my own block and with the family to do it ourselves. I've concluded I actually don't need to. From a purely selfish personal perspective, I can vicariously live through other people's farms. I'm not kidding. I actually reached a fundamental conclusion where, instead of doing this for me, I'm actually doing it because I get to come on the farms, see beautiful landscapes, see the water clear up over time. I get to see the platypus and the trout and the insects and all the stuff that we see here today, the hawks, the eagles. I don't need to own the farm for that, right?
Yep.
I'm pretty blessed. I get to wander around other people's business, and yes, it's their farm, it's their landscape. I can contribute when I can, so I get a buzz out of that. Whether I'm doing that, why I'm doing that, and who it's for, no, I think I just want to be able to contribute and keep learning too. I'm always learning. I think that some of that gets easier, some of that gets harder. I'd personally like to see a lot more. I'd like to nail it down. I'd like to see it bedded down. I'd like to see a lot more systemization, codification, if you like, of a lot of these disparate elements that are in people's experience and heads over the population. And it all just gets easier and simpler, and then there's more time to actually enjoy the quiet stuff, you know, the really simple good stuff, which is actually just being in the landscape and listening to grass being consumed. I mean, we've got cattle here now. I think it's one of the simplest pleasures in the universe to sit and listen to the cud being chewed, to actually smell it, to hear grass being ripped out of the ground. That's about as close to utopia as I get. And how that looks 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I don't really think about it other than that it all needs to get a bit simpler. It all just needs to flow a bit more cleanly. And, yeah, data underpins that, and data gets easier, right, because everywhere we look now, data is getting easier. And that's pretty cool because, yeah, I'm old, maybe I'm young to some, but I remember when we were writing on that old paper and I was getting faxes on the paper business to then send through recommendations and talking to people and having to ring them from the phone box by the side of the road to work out where the farm was. That's in one generation, right? Look at us now with the tech that we've got here, let alone what my kids' kids see. I think we're all kidding ourselves if we can see what that looks like. But for me, more of the same. And the perfect balance is time on the farm that keeps it genuine, not getting carried away with thinking we know more than we know, but then time in the cave to go and validate, theorise, explore, make sure that we do learn what we don't know that we thought we knew.
I'm just trying to think how we ran this out, really, and I don't know the answer to that. Thank you for bringing me here. Thank you for spending a good portion of your day with me. It's been really insightful, and I've learned a lot. So I know podcasting isn't your most comfortable thing to be doing, but I really appreciate your time and insights today.
Well, trying not to mumble and articulate my words, as people will often remind me to do, is is good, Matt, and it's nice to have a chat. And the more I talk about it, the more I think about it, and the questions that you're asking, the more that comes to me. I'll be thinking about all the things I didn't say on the ride home.
Well, I'm happy to do a second interview whenever you want, so let me know.
Good on you, Matt.
Thank you.
To learn more about how Atlas Carbon helps graziers investigate their soil carbon potential, visit the Atlas Carbon website. And to learn more about how Meyer Grazing helps livestock producers make great grazing decisions, visit the Meyer Grazing website.